rather than starting a longer book and then having to stop it for Passover, I instead decided that we would do a nice little short book for a couple weeks that we've never done before. A book that is strangely appropriate to our time. That is the book of Habakkuk, or Habakkuk in the Hebrew. And that's one of those books that if someone came in the middle of the night and razored it out of most people's Bibles, it would be years before they found out. But it still is a book that is very appropriate and very relevant to the things that go on today. So we're going to do the first two chapters of Habakkuk today. They're short chapters. Not very much is known about Habakkuk. It's a short little book, and the details of it don't really tell you anything about Habakkuk. They don't tell you when he lived. We can kind of guess, or scholars have guessed, that he probably lived right after the reign of Josiah, because that was a point at which the morality of the land took a nosedive. But it may not have been. It might have been before that. Certainly, we know it was before the Babylonians came and ran roughshod over Israel, because that's what's being prophesied here. But we don't know how much before. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1. The oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw. How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you, violence, yet you do not save. Why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Therefore the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore justice comes out perverted. Habakkuk looked around at the tenor of the land and said, this is a mess. This is really messed up and corrupt and sinful. Why don't you do something about this? I think what he was probably thinking was, God, why don't you bring revival to this land? Why don't you turn the hearts of these people back to you? Why don't you bring us back to that righteousness that we really enjoyed in years past? Why don't you make yourself real in the miracles like we've had in the Exodus from Egypt and the time of our ancestors, something to open up the eyes of these people and get their attention so they'd stop all this nonsense? Kind of like what we're seeing today. I mean, in our land, we're seeing this, certainly violence all around us. Shocking violence. I mean, they show stuff on the... I was just thinking it's like something about the news enjoying putting gross things on when I'm trying to eat either breakfast or dinner. But they put things on the news that would have been X-rated 20 years ago in the movie theaters. You wouldn't let anybody under, what was it, 17 in to see those things. But yet it's all around us. We see it and it doesn't bother us that much to see and understand all the violence and the wickedness all around us. We've gotten there a little bit at a time, ratcheted a little bit more, each year a little bit worse. Kind of like a relatively minor thing, you know, people on the roads with speed limits. I complain about going to work. I don't even drive the pass this way because people are just too dangerous on those roads. It's like they're so almost savage in the way they drive nowadays, much more so than in years past. And there's one particular road that I drive on that it's like when I first was driving at the speed limit 55, and people, you know, would drive 56 or 57, and then they were driving 60, and then they were driving 65, and now it's not uncommon, and I do not go with them, but I'm just estimating the speed of these people as they go rushing by me and leaving a cloud of dust in their path, that they're probably traveling 75 or 80 miles an hour on this road instead of 55 miles an hour. And they didn't just get there a little bit at a time, get there all at once, rather. They got there a little bit at a time over the years. And that's indicative of the morality of the entire culture. We're doing things today that our parents would have no idea. They would be aghast. They would be amazed at this, at what in the world was going on. That we would get this place morally this quickly. That we would have such a wholesale abandonment of God's principles. And the ultimate response to that is violence and evil occurring all around us. So God's answer that he gives isn't exactly what Habakkuk was asking for. Verse 5, look among the nations, observe, be astonished, wonder, because I am doing something in your eyes. You would not believe it if you were told. So far, so good. All right, God's going to bring a miracle. Verse 6, for behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. They are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and keener than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping down to devour. All of them come for violence. Their horde of faces moves forward. They collect captives like sand. They mock at kings and rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. Then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on, but they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. In other words, all right, God says, all right, I've been watching. I see what's going on. Here's what I'm going to do. You know these guys up north, these Chaldeans, these Babylonians, they may not look like much now, except that they're really mean. They're coming here. They're coming to this land, and they're going to execute judgment upon this land, a judgment like this land has never seen before. But don't worry, I'm going to hold them guilty. But in the meantime, they're going to do what I want them to do, which is to chastise the people of Israel for the way that they're living. Sometimes God brings revival. Sometimes he brings judgment. Sometimes he tears down the land. Sometimes he makes terrible things happen to get people's attention. He uses even the evil and the wicked as part of his plan in order to chastise those who should know better. Verse 12. Now Habakkuk responds. He is absolutely aghast that God would use people like this, these mean terrors in order to do his will. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed men to judge. You have appointed them to judge, and you, O Rock, have established them to correct. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Why have you made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they offer a sacrifice to their net and burn incense to their fishing net, because through these things their catch is large and their food is plentiful. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? In other words, God, whoa, 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 God, whoa, wait, let's wait a minute. Yeah, we're bad, but we're not as bad as they are. So why are we getting this judgment and they're not? Why are you bringing this judgment to us by means of these people that need judgment more than we do? Chapter 2, verse 1. I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart. And I'll keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. So Habakkuk says, okay, God, I'm going to stand here and wait for the answer. Basically, all right, God, here's my problem. And would you please tell me what's going on? So verse 2 until the end of the chapter is going to be God's response. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets, that the one who reads it may run. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal, and it will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it will certainly come, it will not delay. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. Furthermore, wine betrays the haughty man, so that he does not stay at home. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and he is like death, never satisfied. He also gathers to himself all nations and collects to himself all peoples. So he's talking about the Chaldeans and also about the people of Israel, and also really about people all through history of all cultures and places, especially in verse 4, talking about pride, about the proud one, how the soul of the proud one is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. I have seen countless people brought down by pride, people who just refuse to listen to what God has to say, people who think that they have the answer, people who have a yes but response when you read to them God's word. You say, this is what God says. Yes, I see it, but. Well, but nothing. I know it's hard. God never said it was going to be easy. God never said that his way was something that makes sense to the world around us. But living by our faith implies humbling ourselves, that we would be willing to listen to what God has said and not just listen in the sense of, all right, fine, I read my Bible for today, snap, time to go to work. And never think another moment about the things of God until the next morning when you open up that Bible again. That's not what God is talking about here. Righteous living by his faith, it also means in the New Covenant, it broadens that to say, the righteous will live by faith. In other words, you are trusting in God, and that means that you do things that the world around us thinks are a little peculiar at best and idiotic at worst. Praying in school, the world around us looks at that and said, that doesn't make any sense. Why in the world would prayer change anything? We need more social programs. Well, some social programs are a good idea. Social programs done without the will of God are only going to make things worse. We might be saying, well, things are really tough. Things are really tense. So I got to stop and pray. People around us say, that doesn't make any sense. Things are going badly, we're doing badly financially, so I've got to make sure that my heart is right with God. That doesn't make any sense to people around us. Things are going badly for me, so I must pray and ask God to show me what I am doing wrong. How many people do that? Right? Come to God and say, Lord, things are going really badly. Show me what I'm doing here. Show me where the sin is that's causing this to happen in my life. What's going on? That's the pursuit of a godly man as opposed to a godly man or woman as opposed to a proud one. You watch someone how they react. As soon as they start reacting with pride, as soon as they start bristling, as soon as they start saying, you can't tell me anything. Well, you're right, I can't tell you anything, but God can. And what you're rejecting is God's word, then you're rejecting God, and things are not going to go too well after that. And believe me, it's amazing how it happens to people who have seemingly at least been putting on a good facade of living as a believer, that all of a sudden they do something that's way off in left field. That makes you go, so you stop and you say, what was that all about? And the answer is, don't talk to me, I know what I'm doing. But, slam, okay. Verse 6. Will not all of these take up a taunt song against him, even mockery and insinuation against him, and say, okay, and say opens up this taunt song against the proud man. In particular, the Babylonians and the Chaldeans, but generally to all those who desire to live like that. There are five woes, or five things that God speaks about. The first woe is at the end of this verse, down to verse 8. Woe to him who increases what is not his, for how long, and makes himself rich with loans. Will not your creditors rise up suddenly, and those who collect from you awaken? Indeed, you will become plunder for them. Because you have looted many nations, all the remainder of the peoples will loot you. Because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town and all its inhabitants. The first woe is because of this grabbing things that was not theirs, looting things, extorting things, taking things from other people, something Babylonians did, looting the nations around them to say, I'll take that, just because they were stronger, rolling into town and saying, give me that. Verse 9 through 11 is the second woe. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to put his nest on high, to be delivered from the hand of calamity. You have devised a shameful thing for your house by cutting off many people, so you are sinning against yourself. Surely the stone will cry out from the wall, and the rafter will answer it from the framework. Evil gain. Not all gain is good. Not all gain is good. I had people say, it must be the right thing. Look how God has blessed it. But you dig deeper, it wasn't God's blessing. It was because of some shady deal that you were involved in. Well, that's evil gain. That's a shameful thing. When it says the stone's crying out, that means that even though you think nobody else knows how you got that, how you came up with that gain, God knows how you came up with that gain. It's going to come back on you someday. It's not going to last. Anybody can build a house out of cardboard that'll last a day. But it's not going to last more than a day or two. First time a strong wind or the rain comes by, it's gone. Yeshua talked about building your house on the rock as opposed to building your house on the sand. Part of building your house on the rock is building it the right way without evil gain. Next woe, third woe from verse 12 through 14. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. Is it not indeed from the Lord of hosts that peoples toil for fire and nations grow weary for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. There's right and wrong way to build a city, an empire, to build a reputation, to build a business, to build a household. Success is not the justification for how you got there. You got to do it right. You got to do it right. Not with bloodshed and violence. A lot of the major corporations that we see today, you read about the history of what they were doing, and you say, wow, they are not nice people. They are not nice people at all. I mean, they would do things, some large companies would do things like they'd take some of their competitors' products and corrupt them so they were inferior, so they wouldn't work right, and then demonstrate them to customers and say, see, that's what our competition has. Things like that. I mean, just totally off the wall. You read about some of these shady practices of appropriating things that weren't theirs, and it's just things that you as a believer have no part in. Beware of business deals that come to you that involve tearing somebody else down. That's why I think gambling is wrong, because in gambling, for someone to win, somebody else has to lose. What you really should search for instead is something everybody wins. Verse 15, woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk so as to look on their nakedness. You will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. Now you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and the devastation of its beasts by which you terrified them, because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town, and all of its inhabitants. Creeping immorality. Sounds like fun. Doesn't end well. Verse 18, and the last woe is 18 through 20. What profit is the idol when its maker has carved it, or an image a teacher of falsehood? For its maker trusts in his own handiwork when he fashions speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a mute stone, arise, and that is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all inside it. That's the idol, but the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. God, on the other hand, is very much alive and very much in his holy temple. So what do we make of this today? First question that comes up is that We've seen some very brutal places that seem to be exist for quite a while. I mean, you look at the history of ancient Rome, they were some rather nasty people. But yet the reign of the Romans lasted for several hundred years, depending on when you want to call about the fall of Rome, because the fall of Rome wasn't just, you woke up one morning and the cities were standing, the people were happy, and the next day the cities were in ruin and the people were screaming. It didn't work like that. It was a slow, gnawing corruption that went on for centuries until finally you said, well, okay, this is when the last emperor lived and the destruction of the place. But it's not like a nation is really, really bad. And so as that nation is doing its corrupt thing, it's like in the movies, you see you go back into outer space and you see this asteroid change course. And you see it, all of a sudden head more towards this earth, and God's kind of lining it up, ready to take out that. It's not like that. It's not like that at all. Things seem to be a little different nowadays also, in that we seem to have nations that are getting away with quite a bit. The first thing to remember is that we're talking on God's time scale, we're not talking about man's time scale. Even when this was written, when God said, don't worry, I'm going to take care of the Babylonians after they take care of you, the Babylonians took Israel out about 70 or 80 years before they themselves fell as a people. So in God's time scale, 80 years was no big deal. In a human lifetime, it is a very big deal. It's one human lifetime. So when you look at things in the world today and you say, well, this nation or this people is getting away with murder, literally, well, just wait. Just wait. Just wait. God will take care of it. And a lot of times it doesn't even have to be something supernatural. I said that the Romans fell and it took them centuries to fall. Well, you look at it, what brought them down was corruption, and it got worse and worse and worse until just the natural consequences of living lives that are not in accordance with God's plan will eventually bring down a civilization. When you walk away from the Ten Commandments, your society no longer has any order to it. When you say, well, thou shalt not kill, well, thou shalt not steal, well, thou shalt not bear false witness, well, thou shalt not bear adultery, well, once we consider that, well, you take all those things away from a society and you don't have much of a society left. You have people just out for themselves. The one with the biggest gun wins. Right? And so that's the natural consequence as a result of that. So we might be looking around today and saying, wow, this particular place is getting away with murder, literally. Or how in the world could they do that and not have God's judgment? Well, one of the things is that God works on God's time scale. The other thing that's going on is that we live in a different age. Scholars use the term dispensation, but we won't go too far down that road. The basic issue is, there we had Israel, God working in a special way as a testimony to the nations around. So really Israel was on center stage. So really the focus was on Israel as opposed to the nations around. That is no longer God's focus today. So really we have the whole world marching together in a certain direction. What the world is marching towards is not a judgment of one group against another, but what the world is marching towards is overall universal judgment of the entire world. And so as we watch things getting worse and worse, and we say, well, God, why aren't you doing anything? The answer is, well, worse and worse is the plan. Worse and worse until Yeshua comes back. That's the way it's supposed to work. Yeshua warned us that things are going to come unglued. He said that lawlessness shall have increased, the love of many will grow cold. In his discussion of the end of the age, in Matthew 24. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it talks about the mystery of lawlessness that's already at work. But something is restraining that mystery of lawlessness, which will then be released in order to completely overtake this world. Well, we read about in the Torah portion, back in Exodus 32. How the Jewish people went mad. Started worshiping an animal. A gold image of an animal. And using that as an excuse for all sorts of terrible immorality. We look at that and say, that's stupid. But yeah, we look at the things that are sweeping this world today. We say, well, that's stupid too. Why in the world would you... You look at the nation that gave rise to a certain idea, and the nation's a mess. But yet, for some reason, people nowadays said, ooh, that's a clever idea. Let's take on that same idea. Where the nation that invented it, the nation that practices it, is a wreck. But somehow we're smarter, and so we won't be wrecked. We look at the world around us. It is tempting to be like Habakkuk and say, Lord, what's going on here? Why in the world aren't you dealing with this now? Because we're seeing this rise of violence. We're seeing the rise of immorality and evil. Lord, why don't you send revival? Maybe you will. Or maybe we're just watching this march towards overall judgment, towards universal judgment. Well, almost universal judgment, because it doesn't include believers. So it's universal on those who don't believe. But the whole world is marching towards the cliff. They're marching towards the precipice. And they're not even... Not only are they not concerned about the cliff, they're embracing the cliff. It's like there's a big sign. Learn how to fly. $2 on the side of the cliff. So we as believers, as we're watching this, what is remarkable is how little people seem to be concerned about what's going on in the world around us, that they think this is progress, that is the march of human society. Well, it is the march of human society, but societies can march in good directions and they can march in bad directions. So it's easy as believers to get all stirred up by this and cry out like Habakkuk and say, Lord, what's going on? How can you do this? But God's got it all under control. Just like he could bring the Chaldeans to judge the people of Israel, so he could bring this whole plan that Scripture talks about, the rise of the Antichrist, the plagues upon the world, and all the rest of it. And that's part of God's plan too. Not everybody lives happily ever after. Not every civilization gets called back from the brink by God's revival. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. America has had several major revivals that have pulled us back from the brink. Times when we were in desperate situation and sinking into immorality. Will he do it again? He might. He might not. He might not. We could be, at our generation, standing on the mountaintop, watching the dust in the distance of the Chaldeans coming at us to bring judgment. In this case, the Chaldeans are most likely the next generation of people that we ourselves have raised badly. I'm not saying people in this room, but as a culture, you know, that the things that we have not instilled into this generation as they were young, that now they're getting old, older, that taking on the reins of responsibility, and we'll see what happens next. Maybe I'm just getting old and cynical, but I don't think so. I'm watching some of the surveys and things they've been taking of the younger generation, and it's showing a bad trend, very bad trend. And if not this generation, they're going to have children, and they're going to not teach their children even the very rudiments of righteous living that they might dimly remember from their childhood. And unless God brings revival, bad things are going to continue to happen. Go from bad to worse. It's fun for a while, until it's not. We as believers have to keep remembering God is in control. He knows what he's doing. That we as believers, it is not our business to get worried and upset about what God is doing in the rest of the world or even our own country. Our job is to live the righteous life of a believer no matter what's going on all around us, no matter what people are saying, no matter what people are thinking, no matter what people are calling us or saying about us or believing about us. We still need to remain faithful. I said the righteous will live by his faith. We don't go underground. We don't stop living for God. We don't pretend we're something that we're not. But instead, we draw even closer to God. We should become even more dedicated to following him, to obeying him, to embracing his righteousness, even as the things around us become more and more unglued, that we should keep looking up, for our redemption is drawing near. Let's pray. Dear God and Father, I thank you that you warned us. You told us in your word that things weren't going to get sunnier and sunnier and pleasanter until just everything was all right everywhere. Forgive us for being fearful and upset and afraid. And even in this topsy-turvy world where things are happening so quickly and things can change at a moment's notice, that you're still in control, that you have not only every action of every human being in this world, but you know how many hairs are in each and every one of their heads. You know what every atom in their bodies are doing. You have it all in control, and nothing is beyond you. Nothing has gotten out of your grip, but you're working the whole world together towards that plan that you have that will result in the coming of your kingdom and the ultimate glorification of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen.